This Week in Retronauts, Megami. To say Megami. Okay, never mind. Hi everyone, welcome to Retronauts episode. I always forget to look up the episode number, but that means you know who this is hosting. That's right, it's Jeremy Parrish, the guy who always forgets to look up the episode number. It's 628. That is not the number of the beast at all. We're way short, but we're getting there. And as part of our approach to the number of the beast, I thought it was time to look at the most devilish of Famicom games, of RPGs, the Megami Tensei series. Really, I think we need to talk about the Shin Megami Tensei series and the Persona series and all those games, but it doesn't feel right, you know, in a show about history and chronology to just jump right into the good stuff. We got to do the groundwork. That's part of video game history too. Getting through the kind of early grind until the good stuff shows up. And I'm not saying that these are bad games, just that you can definitely see what the later games in the series, the spin-off series, if you will, brought to the table to improve on the foundations that we will discuss over the next hour and a half or so. So with me here to talk about the early Megami Tensei games, no Shin, no Persona, just Megami. We have returning our occasional guest that I call in when we need to talk about Westone or other cool topics like that. That's you, Kurt.
Hello, I'm Kurt Galata.
Hello, Kurt. Welcome back.
Yes, thank you.
And joining us, I think, for the first time on Retronauts, I feels like you should have been on the show sooner, but probably you haven't.
Well, we planned this a while ago.
Something I'm forgetting about. Yes, that's true. Please introduce yourself, newcomer.
It's me, Dia Lucina. Hi, everyone.
Yes, this is a perfect topic for the two of you because you are both well-versed and well-studied in the early history of Japanese RPGs and know a lot about kind of the background of this series, and of anyone I know are the most likely to be able to say something coherent about these two early Famicom games that have never been localized officially, certainly more so than I can. So I'm counting on both of you to save my bacon this episode and make it awesome. So no pressure, but we are going to venture into the dungeon of history to talk about kind of uncharted territory, because really, how many Americans have played Megami Tensei? I feel like it's not very many.
Wild if this had come out back then.
It was just like at the height of, like, you know, the satanic panic. Like dropping Megami Tensei. Wow. Yeah, that would have been very interesting in America.
Yeah, I was going through the sprite sheets for Megami Tensei 2 yesterday, and I don't think there is another game on a Nintendo system that has more bare boobs in it. I was actually shocked by just how many topless naked women sprites are in, or like beast women especially, are in that sprite sheet. It's remarkable. So there would have been a lot of changes being made to both the visuals and the storyline of Megami Tensei 1 and 2 if they had made it to the US at the time. But bear in mind that the time was 1987. By that point, we had never actually seen a proper RPG on consoles in America, so it would have been a lot of heavy lifting. And when we did finally get console RPGs, they were a lot more, I would say, of the accessible mold. Phantasy Star, Ultima, and, you know, that Dragon Warrior game. This Megami Tensei is much more, like, even from the very beginning, was much more of like a, this is, you know, an RPG for the the grumpy old men in the audience, more so than the kids. And not just in terms of all the naked demonesses, but just, you know, thematically and in terms of difficulty and what it expects of players, it's much more, it draws much more on the personal computer heritage of RPGs, as opposed to really going out of its way to make things accessible and friendly for console players. And, you know, in a way, it's remarkable that this series survived and is still running strong and is, you know, kind of grown into one of the top RPG franchises in the world. But it did do a lot of adapting to get to that point. So we're looking at the early games that made no concessions. They just said, you will take these games as they are and you will like them, or you can go away. We don't care. It's a very unrelenting, uncompromising, pure, brutal role-playing gaming, and I respect that. So I have to ask each of you, what kind of experience do you have with the first two Megami Tensei games and with the Megami Tensei, Shin Megami Tensei franchise as a whole? Dia, I'm curious to hear kind of your background here.
Well, I got into it from Revelations Persona, which just looked weird and sounded cool. And it was a Blockbuster one day. And I was just like, yeah, I'll rent this thing. I brought it home and just instantly fell in love with high school students with machine guns summoning demons in what was ultimately just like a straightforward dungeon crawler with, you know, vaguely tactical combat. And so from there, like, I just kind of followed what Atlas was putting out in America. You know, it's like, okay, well, what did we get? Okay, we got, you know, the second part of Persona 2. Was it the second part that we got first?
It was, I think, the first part. I think we got...
At this point, I can no longer keep track of...
Innocent Sin, but not Eternal Punishment.
Right, okay, that's what it was, yeah. And now we have...
And then later on PSP, we got the remake of Eternal Punishment, but they couldn't make Innocent Sin because apparently they lost some of the files for it or something. So we just got like the PS1 dump
that's
Innocent Sin.
It was flipped around. We got Eternal Punishment in the PlayStation, which was the second part of the game, and then we got the first one, but they did do the remake. Yeah,
right. That's
okay.
Yeah. So I kind of followed on from there, and then it was like, you know, and then we finally started getting like the Shin Megami Tensei. What was it? There's a Digital Devil Story, I think was.
Mm-hmm. I think Nocturne came here first.
Nocturne came here first.
On PS2, yeah.
God, I'm trying to remember like the early aughts. Yeah, and so then it went from there. And then I finally started going back and trying to piece together what was available on emulator and what was actually translated and things like that, and, you know, making sense of it that way. But yeah, so that's my history with the franchise.
So a legitimate history, you know, very, very authentic, pretty much from the start. I mean, you skipped Jack Brothers, but I guess that's understandable because who actually owned a Virtual Boy and said, yeah, I want to play this game with the horrible, ugly box art.
The thing is, I played Jack Brothers. I just didn't know. I didn't have like a reference for it at the time.
Oh, okay. Well, because it was there. You go. So you really were in on the ground floor.
Yeah. No, I had a Virtual Boy. Loved that thing.
Oh, well, congratulations. One of the few.
Rich kids having yard sales in my neighborhood. That was the way to pick it up because they hated it, and I was like, all right, whatever.
It's the best way to get a lot of LaserDiscs.
Here's $20. Give me your Virtual Boy.
If you'd waited a month, you could have gotten it at Toys R Us for $20. Brand new in box. All right, Kurt, what about you? What's your Megaton tale?
I didn't play the first Persona because I didn't get a PlayStation until Final Fantasy VII came out, and that was sort of from the before times.
Yeah,
I did play Persona 2 Eternal Punishment, and I didn't really get it, which, of course, even at the time, you realized that you were sort of coming in the middle of a story, and they were trying to do your best to catch you up on what the heck had happened in the other game that hadn't come out. So I didn't play it a whole lot. But then it was maybe about 2003, 2004, I was in the dealer's room at Otakon and found Shin Megami Tensei 2 for like $10. I was like, I don't know what this game is, but I think I had heard about it on like the Gaming Intelligence Agency from back then. Like, I'll give it a shot, and just kind of fell into documenting this weird series that had all these links that we had very barely experienced in the English-speaking world. And it was a good time to get into it because it was maybe a year or so before it made its proper debut in North America with Shin Megami Tensei Nocturne. And from there, they were making regular PS2 games. So there was, I don't know how many games, 5, 6, 7 of them before.
Yeah,
that.
There were the Digital Devil Saga games, two of those, and the Kazunoa Raido games, there were two of those. I feel that and Nocturne, I feel like those were the ones we got on PS2, but then, you know, we went over to the DS era and got all kinds of stuff there. There were some Game Boy spinoffs, Devil Kids.
Yeah. Revelations. Yeah. That may have been one of the first ones. It was a Game Boy of the Last Bible.
Yeah, Revelations of Demon Slayer. Yeah. Yeah, then also the Dimmy Kids. I want to say those came here to Game Boy Advance. Is that right?
Yeah, the Devil Children games. Those were your Game Boy Color games. Because the lineage of monster collecting is Megami Tensei sort of established that, but it was Dragon Quest V that really popularized it in the Japanese consciousness. And then Pokemon came out and just was a worldwide phenomenon. So at that point...
And now everyone is like, oh, that Shin Megami Tensei, it's such a just a Pokemon ripoff.
Yeah.
I love to read that. It always makes me happy.
So at that point, like, both Atlas and Enix made their own Pokemon clones, basically.
Yeah, okay, so compared to the two of you, I'm a total lightweight who was aware of the Persona and Megaten games, but just never had the time or incentive to try them out. I'd heard mixed things. Some people loved them, some people hated them. So it wasn't until... Actually, you know what it was? It was Etrian Odyssey. I fell in love with that. And then when Strange Journey, SMT 4, 3.5, I guess, before SMT 4, came out, I was like, oh, well, that's, you know, basically Etrian Odyssey, but with Shin Megami Tensei. And that made me say, oh, this is a really cool series. So I kind of worked my way back from there and forward, you know, especially once the series went into the portable sphere, because it's, for whatever reason, just much easier for me to sit down with a portable game and play. So... SMT4 and Apocalypse and so forth, Devil Survivor, yada yada. So so there's a lot of Megami Tensei, Shin Megami Tensei, etc. games, and all of them kind of spiral outward from the two games we're talking about today, Megami Tensei and Megami Tensei 2, which I guess for the full title is Digital Devil Monogatari Megami Tensei and Megami Tensei 2, but close enough. But I think to really properly understand what these games were and what they sort of represented at the time, we need to do another refresher on the state of Japanese RPGs as of 1987. Because, you know, I think having both of you who know a lot about early Japanese RPGs on the show is a great opportunity to push back against the narrative that kind of shows up where people say, oh yes, Dragon Quest was birthed from, you know, Yuji Horii's head, fully formed, sprang forth into the world and gave us the Japanese RPG, which is extremely not true. And, you know, to kind of get to Dragon Quest and Megami Tensei, there was a whole lot of backstory there. And Megami Tensei in particular really draws heavily on primal forms of games like wizardry and really reaches back into the past of video game history. And even, I would say also, maybe more so than any other JRPG at the time, really leans on concepts that you saw in tabletop RPGs but hadn't really been explored in video games, like demon negotiation and, you know, parlaying with enemies as opposed to just killing them. Which I think early video games didn't really have the bandwidth to allow that to happen. So it was kind of remarkable in Megami Tensei that is such a core mechanic, and it really kind of reaches beyond earlier JRPGs and Western RPGs and into sort of the primal analog roots of the genre, in my opinion, but maybe I'm mistaken, in which case it is now your opportunity to correct me and tell me why I'm wrong.
Well, you know, one of my favorite things, you know, that I got to do recently was shove the Portopia serial murder case in an article about the birth of JRPGs, because, you know, it is like that is bringing in that kind of, you know, extensive kind of more adventure game style thing. And it is more of a tabletop thing. You're right. Like, I think that does draw, you know, it brings in, like, you know, leans heavily in on, like, how do tabletops work? And versus your kind of standard dungeon crawler, or, you know, even something like, you know, Final Fantasy, that's much more narrative driven, but still it doesn't have that moment to moment. We're breaking from combat to do something that is not combat. And I think that's a really interesting thing that Megami Tensei 1, you know, introduces. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't actually think of an RPG before Megami Tensei that involved coaxing or threatening or bribing bad guys to join your party. The closest thing I can really think of would be Wizardry 4, where you play as the villain. So you spend a lot of time summoning like minor mobs of demons to serve as kind of your dungeon proxies and do your fighting for you. But that's not really, bringing hostile forces over to your side and turning them into allies. It's just, you know, that's what the bad guy does, is he commands all these minor mobs, and he's not that much to speak of himself necessarily, but he has the loyalty and control over all these various, hostile undead forces and kobolds and whatever. So, you know, there was some attempt by various game developers to sort of explore that, but I really feel like the idea of facing off against a bad guy and saying, yo, I've got like $20 here, will you fight by my side? And seeing if the demon says, $20, I could use that, or hey, that's terrible, what are you trying to do, rip me off and attack you instead? That was pretty new. This must have been really weird and interesting if you were a kid in 1987 to pick up this game and say, here's another one of those role-playing games that are becoming so popular, but this is letting me do some interesting stuff because I've only got two guys in my party and they can't do much, you know, after a certain point on their own. But hey, I can pay money or threaten bad guys to become good guys. That's pretty cool.
Right, because even like... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, thanks. There were some early games that did offer a talk command.
Yeah.
I think, you know, when we think about random battles, you think of them like, oh, we're just going to be zipped into a separate battle screen. That wasn't necessarily how they thought of back then. It's more like a random encounter. Because one early game, one that we actually got translated English thanks to Sega, was Miracle Warriors. And you can get dragged into things. You can talk to, like, you would all... you wouldn't just fight monsters. You would find, like, regular people traveling around. And you weren't supposed to fight them. You're supposed to talk to them. And you could try to talk to monsters. I don't think it ever really accomplished much. But I think it was along that same thoroughfare. Like, oh, what if we could talk to monsters? What if you could communicate? And what if they could join you?
Hmm. Oh, yeah. I think of Miracle Warriors as, like, a late 88 game. But I guess looking that up, it actually came out in late 86 on personal computers. So that, I have to admit, the PC, Japanese PC side of video gaming is extremely opaque to me. Even though I've tried to read as much about it as I can, it's still, you know, it's a lot of information to take in if you haven't actually experienced the games yourself. And I don't just have an FM7 sitting around to pop in foreign language games and take them for a spin. So I admit that's a huge blind spot for me. So I hadn't thought about that, but that's a good call. Dee, I think you were going to mention something.
Oh, I was just thinking about, like, you know, before this, we do get, like, weird experimentations. Like, you know, you have something like Wizardry that comes over, and, you know, Wizardry is very straightforward. You know, in terms of what we think of, like, you know, dungeon crawlers now, it's just Wizardry's like, okay, yeah, you get your guys, you go into the dungeon, you come back out, and, like, you know, maybe some of them are dead, and you regroup, and you go back in a little bit further, stuff like that. But then you do get things like Falcom's, Panorama Island. which is like a very weird game that has like kind of very multimodal, like a lot of modes happening simultaneously. You know, that was 1983.
It's like 81. It was really early.
It was just really early. Yeah. Like just doing very weird things that kind of like, you know, not necessarily in the focused way that Megaten then takes that, but it really does. Like there are lots of weird experiments happening. The Dragon and the Princess, I think that had like weird. It's been so long since I even like tried to like look that up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a Koei game.
Yeah,
One of their very few explorations into like an actual, you know, classic kind of take on the RPG.
That was doing just like really weird things with, you know, incredibly kind of, you know, primitive graphics that weren't quite like Rogue like level. They were trying to do more graphics than Rogue, but. you know, that level of thing was also happening in Japan before all this stuff happened too.
A lot of this was in the early PC scene. They would be importing American PCs, trying to play American games. Mm-hmm. And of course that was a little bit difficult because they were imported and you had to play them in English. So when the Japanese PC started coming up, Wizardry hadn't come out yet. Them, so they would just play these games or take their own experience from tabletop role-playing games and make their own stuff. And Wizardry eventually did come out a couple years later, which was a big thing. I think even bigger in America, or than here in America, at least from my understanding. Like, we got Wizardry games here, didn't we, on the Nintendo?
Yeah, we got Wizardry 1 through 3 on NES.
Yeah. I don't remember having any friends that had them. I don't remember seeing any coverage about them. As a kid at the time, I just got the impression that they were just old games that had been ported for some reason.
Yes. I guess they did reasonably well because we did get three of them in total from, Age Tech or someone like that? I don't know. It was like some kind of random label, but I interviewed Robert Woodhead a few years back, and he said he considers the NES version of Wizardry like the definitive version of the game because it's, you know, kind of refined and has the best graphics. So I guess it was, you know, still kind of notable in that respect, even though it was extremely, extremely old by the time it came out. And, you know, extremely old at that time didn't really mean that much, but relatively speaking, yes.
It's funny because I remember like I played the NES. I read the NES version, and I remember just being like, "Wow, this is they really radically improved the graphics on this." But then my child brain was like, "I don't want to sit at on the couch in front of the television and play a long ass RPG. I want to do that at the computer desk." Whereas now I'm like, "Oh, man, you're gonna make me play Baldur's Gate 3 at my desk? Are you kidding me? I could not get further away from my desk."
Too much back pain, yeah.
Yeah, that's why I just play on handhelds. I can play anywhere. I'm in bed, on the sofa, at the doctor's office where, you know, old people like us spend all of our time. So what I'm saying is that Megami Tensei really kind of brought in, I guess, a lot of unconventional elements into the sort of wizardry mold. And so it did offer something pretty unique, especially for the console space in 1987. Other notable dungeon RPGs or just RPGs of 1987 to come out in Japan include the SG-1000 version of Black Onyx. And I gotta tell you, Megami Tensei just absolutely spanks Black Onyx in general, but especially the SG-1000 version. That was a David and Goliath kind of situation, but a situation where Goliath just kind of stepped on David and said, "Yeah, we're done here." Phantasy Star came out. Dragon Quest II came out, and that actually was the game that really kicked off the Dragon Quest craze. And the Mark III version of Miracle Warriors. So it was in pretty good company. Like, this was the year that role-playing games really hit the mainstream of console gaming in Japan. And, you know, the console mainstream was much bigger than the computer mainstream at the time by a factor of, like, 10 or 20. You know, a game that sold 50,000 units on a PC in the 80s in Japan was, like, a full phenomenal hit, just colossal. Whereas, you know, Famicom games, if they were hits, would regularly sell multiple millions of copies. So making that penetration into the console space really allowed the RPG to grow out of this sort of niche fandom and into a sort of more populist appeal and begin to really rapidly mutate into other forms. So you started to see all kinds of games adopting RPG elements in other ways. You had, you know, obviously like Zelda 2 and Simon's Quest and Fazanadu and Wonder Boy and Monster Land and just lots of games adopting those kind of trappings of RPGs and kind of picking and choosing and saying, oh, like, that's a neat thing. I like having numbers that get bigger when you kill things. I like having coins that you can collect to spend in a shop. I like, you know, having a progressive armor upgrade system, but not necessarily bringing over the menu-driven combat or the party systems and things like that. So really, the RPG as it existed in 1987 for Japanese developers was kind of like this buffet, and they could go with their plate and just say, like, oh, I want this item and this item and this item, and this is going to be my meal. I'm going to have, you know, like, these picks from the buffet. I don't need the whole thing. So it was a time of, I think, great creativity and refinement and invention and experimentation, and really paved the way for a lot of modern experiences in a way that, you know, the games of 10 years prior to that did not necessarily do. Like, this was a real period of maturation, in my opinion. Please correct me if you disagree, but I feel like Megami Tensei was a part of that and was, you know, very much involved in this process of experimentation and figuring out, like, what does it mean to make a video game that is more than just a little guy punching blocks for coins and trying to get to the end of the, you know, like, the top of the screen. Like, there's got to be more to it than that. Mm-hmm. And so we get that here.
1987 gives us the only Ultima game that I have ever finished in my entire life on the console, which Ultima 3 Exodus, which is radically different from the PC version, but it's also...
It is.
It's the only Ultima I have ever, like, beaten, and it's probably the only Ultima I will ever play for the rest of my life. unlike the rest of Japan, not a franchise for me. But I think one of the things that's really interesting is that Megaten gives us the moon phases and also the magnetite system, which are really weird. Like, you know, if you think about it in terms of, like, you know, in terms of tabletop, of course, like, having these limitations on, you know, magic use ultimately, like, you know, D&D is like, you know, you have to have spell components, certain spells, and, you know, need your hands free, things like that. You know, you can't just go around blasting magic missile because it's very powerful. But, like, Megami Tensei, like, you're really, really flimsy as a human. You really need your homies, that, like, your demon homies, to come in and, like, buffer for you. But you have to have enough magnetite, first of all. Otherwise, you know, you can't summon your bros. And then, like, you know, depending on the phase of the moon, like, you can't, like, use magic and stuff like that. That you actually need to, like, do things like see the map, which is just, you know, wild. In terms of, like, player limitations and kind of, you know, complications of the actual gameplay that, like, later, like, games just kind of just smooth out entirely. It's like, you know, like, can you imagine, like, no, you don't have the random grindable resource to summon Pikachu? No, it would not fly.
One thing that always threw me for a loop, just trying to wrap my head around it, was just how the demon conversations worked mechanically.
Right.
Because when you think of combat, when you think of magic, mm-hmm. it's just like a mathematical probability formula. It's a roll of the dice. So, like, demon conversation kind of works that way, but it's very, especially in the early games, it's very abstract. So I first started playing in Persona 2, like, each character has their own way of approaching demons. But in the old games, it's just... A lot of it is randomized or is based on things that aren't necessarily communicated to the player. Like, one is the moon phase, since you had brought that up. Because, like, demons are more agreeable or more likely to just attack you. But just trying to understand how that worked was, it's very strange. And it's something that I think they've realized over the years was a little difficult to explain. Because it's so much easier in Persona 5. Because they brought that back in the newer games because people love them. Like, the localizations are stellar in both the recent Shin Megami Tensei and Persona games. So I see people on Twitter posting screen caps of the conversations. But they're also very smooth. Like, in these games, generally, if you say something, they'll join you. Whereas in the older ones, there are so many other things that could go wrong. Like, if you just hit a bunch of bad dice rolls, they'll be like, we don't want to join you. Let's call one of my buddies. So we started with one bad guy, and all of a sudden there's six attacking you, and you're basically just screwed at that point.
Yeah, I have a friend who worked on some Mega 10 localizations, and he's such a quiet guy, so calm and good-natured. But then I would read the demon conversations and be like, wow, you have some hidden depths that I never knew about. It's very interesting to read how you've localized these. So informative.
There's so much behind, like, how they classify different enemies. There's, like, different races and then different ranks in that race, and different races can... they react differently depending on if you're aggressive or not. And a lot of that is random. Like, even if you do, they are agreeable to you. They're like, we want a random amount of money. Oh, we want a random amount of life sucked in from you. And even if you say this stuff, they might run away anyway.
Yeah, I didn't realize that the complexities of demon fusion and the demon charts and affinities and everything went back all the way to the original Megami Tensei. But, you know, I'm kind of having this realization dawn that, that weird monster system in the Final Fantasy Legend, which seems so remarkable and unique at the time, was actually just like a simplification of this, which is not something I really... It had really occurred to me, or that I really even would have had reason to think about. But it's interesting, you know, how the elements of this game just kind of trickled out into other games in kind of unexpected ways. But I didn't realize the moon system actually had a purpose. I looked up some facts on this game as part of research for this because, you know, I've played some Megami Tensei and could not really get my head around some of the systems. I didn't play long enough, I guess, to really kind of get to that point. But even the facts are like, moon phases don't really matter except for like two parts in the game. So you can just ignore it. But it turns out it is actually important. I feel like that's an element that they looked at, you know, Ultima and said, moon phases, that's cool. We should do that. And brought that over and apparently did something kind of oblique but important with it. So that's very much video game design of this era, the mid to late 80s, kind of before the big sort of shakeout of 1987, 88, where everything started to get more user-friendly, where it was like, we've put a bunch of systems in here. We've put a bunch of hidden, invisible things in here. Let's see if you can figure it out.
That was the big kind of like the point that ultimately crashed my attempt at doing a Let's Play of the original Mega 10. Was that, like, it got to the point where it was just such a punishingly, like, you know, kind of obfuscated game that it was just like, this is probably better as, like, a streaming thing and not, like, I'm going to sit here for 3 hours and record a Let's Play. Because otherwise it's just, like, you sitting there going, why the fuck can't I cast a fucking spell? I'm just trying to, Yumiko, just cast the map spell. And it's like, you know, then like finally you realize like in the next episode you record, you're like, it's a new moon and she can't cast magic under the new moon. Okay. All right. Sure. All right. Okay. Fine. you just hours so of frustration.
What do you even do when you can't bring up the map and you're stuck through an entire moon phase? Do you just fart around in town or what?
I mean, you just move around and just, you know, you're like, well, I guess I'm just going to walk up and down this hallway and, like, you know, grind on, like, you know, Baku and hope that, like, you know, that my rolls come up okay.
I like when a video game has respect for your time. I think that's great. So, we've mentioned Atlus here, but Megami Tensei wasn't just Atlus. It was also Namco. Because at the time, Atlus was a brand new baby company. They'd only made a couple of games. This was like their second or third game, actually. And they kind of, the company was established in 1986 and started to make its name in 87, but not really. Because you never really saw their name on anything, because they were doing contract work for companies like LJN and apparently Namco. So they were making stuff like Jaws, or subcontracting that to Westone, and Karate Kid for NES, and then also this. So it really feels like they were all over the place, but I kind of feel like Megami Tensei was not really Atlus's idea so much as Namco saying, hey, we need to make an RPG based on this book. Hey, developer, like contract developer, will you do this for us? I don't know, because I've never been able to find like, you know, a real oral history of the Megami Tensei series. Atlus is pretty close-lipped about things and doesn't really talk about the early stuff.
No, the best that I was ever to find, like, I found an interview with the author, Aya Nashitani, who wrote the light novels, the digital devil story, Megami Tensei. And, like, basically the publisher, like, you know, they published a book, and then they were like, well, we're going to make an anime. We're going to do an OVA. And then there's also, you know, video games are kind of big right now. Why don't we make a video game out of this? Because we think, you know, it's computers, it's like demons, it's high school kids. You know, that they'll love that with the video games. Which, like, it makes sense. Like, yeah, okay, sure. Like, you made the light novels. Those did well enough. Make the anime. Okay, that did. I actually don't know how well the anime, the OVA did, because it's beautiful garbage.
That's bubble economy anime OAVs for,
like,
right,
oh,
there.
Man, it's beautiful.
Just, like, beautiful and so bad.
It's like one of those things that, like, it's definitely, like, you know, in my list of, like, here are my OVAs that I force on people who were born after all anime became digipaint. like,
there is something to be said for, like, real ink and you know, celluloid.
There's like we know, just, when
so good.
When Loki decides to do weird tentacle through the computer takeover of, like, the bank, and, like, just starts, like, just squishing, like, he just goes full Akira on, like, these bank tellers for no reason other than we can animate this. Let's do it. It's great, you know? It's a 45-minute anime, and you spend, like, 10 minutes of it just squishing, you know, bank tellers and high school students. No notes.
Ah, the 80s.
But, like, I don't remember where I read it, but I swear I could remember seeing the one of the co-founders of Atlus and the programmer, Koji Okada, I believe. And
yeah,
he was a Wizardry fan, and he just wanted to make a Wizardry game.
That's so good.
Yeah.
So at the time, let's talk about Namco, because at the time they were pretty much the gods of the arcade, but they were also gods of Famicom. You know, they had been so successful with games like Pac-Man, Galaga, and in Japan, Zevius and Tower of Draga and Dragon Buster were all huge, huge hits. And of course, they were, you know, in on the ground floor with third-party licensing for Famicom, along with Hudson. You know, they entrenched themselves into the Nintendo Famicom market and did a lot of publishing for other companies. Like, they would bring other companies' games to the system, or at least publish them. Stuff like, you know, I want to say, like, Ring King, Burger Time.
Yeah, all the DD stuff came through them.
Yeah, stuff you wouldn't really associate with Namco, but, you know, they had the traction. and the clout and the, you know, the distribution. So people were like, publish our game. So it would make sense that when, you know, whoever held the property for this novel and was like, time to make spinoffs of it, would go to Namco because they were the name on Famicom for third-party stuff. And then I could see, like, the chain of events here being Namco saying, okay, so we're going to do this game about demons. Let's give it to a subcontractor. And the subcontractor said, cool, I love wizardry. Let's do a wizardry game with demons. And that's where you end up. Because this could easily have been, you know, there were actually two Megami Tensei games. We're not talking about the computer game this episode. But it was pretty much like a very clunky Legend of Zelda. That was from Telenet, I think.
Yeah. Let's put some respect on that.
No. I was just trying to remember who made it. It was a Telenet game and was... Okay, it was a clunky Golvelius.
Okay, that's better. I'll accept that.
Okay. So it was, you know, kind of trending into that RPG space a little bit, but the Namco Atlas game went full on, this is a wizardry clone with windowed interfaces and menus and, you know, text-based commands and equipments and armors, and like there's a town at the beginning that you can go to. It's the real deal. It's hardcore, full-on, full frontal role-playing game.
I really do want to know, because apparently Atlas helped Telenet with their game.
Huh.
And like, yeah, they collaborated on it, and I really want to know, it's like, did you just shoot them in the foot? Because I remember struggling to get the PC-88 emulator, because I'm like, I gotta play the Telenet. I'm like, these are my people. Like, you know, let's go. And then getting it to play it, like, and I was like, what the fuck were you guys doing? You're going to go, you're the team that goes on to make El Viento? Are you kidding me? Because it's not good.
Telenet was a company.
Somewhere.
Telenet was a company that put out a lot of games. And by playing the games, you can tell that they put out a lot of games in a very short amount of time.
Yeah, and I mean, Atlas didn't exactly have the most sterling start either. Like, you don't get Run Saber without the Karate Kid. So everyone has their start.
Another early Atlas game, Friday the 13th? Some sort of Erica and Satoru's Dream Adventure or something like that, which was one of those famous Famicom games for, like, a hidden message.
All the wrong reasons, yeah.
Some guy complaining about his coworkers.
Yep.
King of Kings slaps, though.
Yes, I feel like the programmer behind that secret message was also like the living version of Nakajima from Megami Tensei. Like the tone and just misanthropy and misogyny in that hidden message is like, this guy definitely had like a personal connection to the Megami Tensei light novel. Anyway, I didn't expect that to flop quite so badly, but...
I was just thinking, God, Nakajima is such, like, a proto-school shooter. Like,
God, he's the worst.
He's just I'd never
played the game first before I knew anything about the anime and stuff. I'm like, Nakajima, he looks like a pretty stand-up guy. And then I watched the anime, and I'm like, oh my God, this guy's terrible. Why is he the hero?
No, it was everyone's like, you know, because Yumiko just kind of dies a lot because Yumiko has no HP and no defense. And she's just like, you know, really important. So like when she dies, it's just like the game is more than happy to kill her off for you. And you just kind of carry around her corpse through the dungeon. You're like, well, I guess I got to walk back to the beginning and with carrying my girlfriend's corpse. And it's just kind of like, you know, when you go and read about Nakajima, when you go read, like, you know, read the light novel or watching anime, you're like, Nakajima is probably way too into this.
He's like, finally, my dream girl, the one who's dead in my arms. So we'll get to the light novel momentarily, but, this is interesting. Like the timing of Megami Tensei is interesting because it's right around the time, just like a few weeks after, I think, the launch of the PC Engine, and that would become a really big part of Namco's business because their relationship with Nintendo had really soured. I think this is a pretty well-known story, but like I said, Namco was second in the door. They had their foot in the door when third parties appeared on Famicom, and they brought all of their best games in really beautiful form to Famicom, like a great version of Pac-Man, a great version of Galaxian, the first home port of Zevius, and it plays great despite the format change. You know, they just were banging out arcade classic after arcade classic and really convincing versions, and that did a lot to drive sales for Famicom. And in the early days of Famicom, there were no real licensing restrictions or rules, but once everyone jumped on the bandwagon, Nintendo was like, wow, we're heading toward an Atari crash of our own. Let's hit the brakes and figure out some sort of licensing requirements. And they went to all their third-party publishers and said, okay, here are the rules now that you have to follow to publish on our system. And they didn't give those initial publishers any special, you know, allowances. They didn't say, well, you were here early on, and our success is largely predicated on the things that you brought to our game console. So as, you know, as our way of saying thank you, we're going to give you special, you know, liberties and allowances. They were just like, yeah, no, you Namco, with all of your amazing ports and conversions and enormous sales, you have to work by the same rules as VAP, the creators of Super Monkey Daiboken. Thank you. And Namco, understandably, was a little sour about that. And Hudson also. So guess who produced a whole lot of content for the PC Engine in competition to the Famicom? So you kind of see this is like at the very end, I think, of the sort of PAX Famicana between Namco and Nintendo. And they start to go their own separate ways after this. Also, you know, Namco had a stake in Atari through Tengen. It's very complicated after the Atari shakeout, and it, like, they bought a big chunk of Atari, and then Atari's employees bought that chunk back from them and created Atari games. But they maintained a relationship with Atari's various entities through Tengen, and then were publishing stuff without license in the U.S. So, you know, in addition to the demons and the Satan and the boobs, I feel like that probably also has something to do with the fact that the Mega 10 games did not come to the U.S. On NES. As for Atlus, they didn't actually self-publish until, as far as I can tell, November 1990, with a puzzle game for Famicom Disk System, long after Famicom Disk System had bothered, like, had any real relevance in the market whatsoever. Like, it was just like the place where you went to get a $5 copy of Golf or something for Famicom at the 7-Eleven. So that almost doesn't count. So they were just, you know, subcontracting, and I feel like they kind of built their reputation and eventually were able to go independent because of the work they did on games like Megami Tensei. So that's the developer history. Hooray! Now on to the light novel, Digital Devil Story Megami Tensei by Aya Nishitani, or Nashitani. I might have mistyped that. So Digital Devil Story Megami Tensei was published in March 1986. It is a light novel, which is to say, you know, it's a slightly thinner paperback novel than, you know, one of those big potboilers. But also the type on the page is really humongous. So it's got like 200 or 300 pages, but it's like 90 pages of text. It's basically a Worlds of Power book, except there was nothing like this in a Worlds of Power book. As they have described poverty in Britain, it's solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. That is Megami Tensei.
Very Stephen King-ish. It has, I think it has a lot of crazy concepts.
And real misanthropy.
Yeah.
So I assume we've all read at least the first Megami Tensei novel.
Yes,
I've only read a bit of it. I've seen just the anime OVA. I mean, that's just pretty much what they adapted, right?
Yeah,
there is a translation online of the first two novels. Let me see if I can dig up the links for those and tell people where to find those.
Yeah, there's three in the original trilogy. Mm-hmm. And then there was another one because it moves to a different protagonist for obvious reasons. And that went on for like five more novels. And there's a whole bunch of other, it goes off in other directions, completely parallel to the, parallel but in different direction to the video game series.
Yes, look for DDS translation on Blogspot. And some kind soul, nearly 20 years ago now, sat down and translated the first two books, at least, maybe the third, I'm not sure. I haven't been able to find the third, but that's because the internet is a mess now, and it's really hard to find anything. Okay. But these are... Oh, go ahead.
Did they actually finish the third translation? Because I remember when I looked for it for my LP, it was forthcoming, I think, was the third translation. Because I read the first two. I was like, well, I guess I'll read these. Like, they're on Blogspot. I might as well just, you know, read these in bed, you know, before I start the LP. And, you know, that's exactly that Blogspot link. I was like, yeah, that's exactly the one I read. But I never got to read the third one.
Yeah, it looks like the third one is not there. It's just the first two novels.
Mm. This is a Japanese site that summarized everything, so I just looked through that.
Fair enough. Yeah, I mean, really, the first two games are what you need to, or the first two books are what you need to get into the games, because the first Megami Tensei game is a sequel to the first two novels. It's basically like an alternate telling of Megami Tensei 3 that I think was published before the book. So, you know, it kind of does that thing that adaptations do where they run out of manga to localize into anime and they're just like, well, where do we go from here? The third book came out in February 1988. So the game actually came out before that. So, you know, think of the video game as seasons 6 through 8 of Game of Thrones, except that George R.R. Martin actually published Winds of Winter. And that's going to be the analogy that I'm going with here. So anyway, yeah, the story behind Megami Tensei is pretty interesting, but like I said, it's very misanthropic. The main character is a real piece of work. He's really hard to like. I feel like there is a lot of this in certain Japanese pop media, things like Death Note. And there's a few other things that just totally slip my mind. But they kind of tap into the brooding loner who secretly longs for revenge. Like, it's, you know, America had stuff like The Revenge of the Nerds, which was problematic in a lot of ways, but ultimately pretty harmless and good-natured for the most part. Whereas I would not call anything about Megami Tensei good-natured. It's kind of mean-spirited. There's a whole lot of people getting killed for petty revenge and horrible things being unleashed upon the world as a result of that petty revenge.
Well, the gist of it is that Nakajima, he learns how to summon demons, and then they go crazy. And then eventually he's like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done that. But by that point, it's way too late. There's just way too much blood on his hands, and... And then later on, almost disconnected from that, he learns that he is the reincarnation of one of the Japanese creation gods, and the new transfer student is a reincarnation of one of the Japanese creation goddesses, and then there's a whole to-do about that. I always thought that was strange, because it doesn't feel like those two things really mesh together. Because the demon he first summons is Loki, right? Like, yeah. That's pretty much the main demon in the first one. And he's not a fun one.
No, he's not like the cute, sexy Loki from Marvel movies. He's like
tell that
the
to
actual
Nakajima's
horrible Loki
teacher.
Yeah,
fair enough. Maybe he does look like Tom Hiddleston.
Yeah, and then he joins up with Cerberus. Like that's where it sort of got the thing. All these different world mythologies and all these demons were real and live in another realm, which can be summoned through use of computer programs, which is something I always really loved. Like, this is going a little bit into the future, but the introduction to Shin Megami Tensei, you see, like, them programming assembly language as, like, the summoning thing. And, like, if you don't know anything about computers, assembly language does look like demonic script. It's just something it's a really cool touch.
Yeah, I think it's notable that in the original Megami Tensei, the good demons are all, like, Japanese gods, you know, characters from Japanese mythology. And the evil demons are generally Western mythological figures. So there is kind of this undercurrent there of like, you know, the local heroes are the good ones. Then there's these foreign interlopers. I don't know if that's necessarily intended, But certainly it is an element of the story. But it, you know, definitely the use of mythology definitely expands way beyond that in the future. And the idea that Nakajima is Izanagi's one of their reincarnations, that's not in the first novel, is it?
It's in the anime, so I'm assuming it's in the novel.
I thought it was.
Yeah.
Okay, so it wasn't like a retcon. Like, no, actually, she's Rey Palpatine. Can't have a normie out there doing good things. Well, actually, the whole thing about Nakajima is that he's not a normie. He's an honor student. He's really smart, but also really good looking. And so the normie girls want him, but he's not interested because he's got, you know, his mind on higher things like school and programming. So one of the jocks beats him up under the orders of one of the normie girls. And he's very, very offended and says, I'm going to go home and finish up my demon summoning program on my computer and use that to summon a demon that will kill these people who hurt me. Like, I feel like that's disproportionate retribution. Like, yes, they messed you up, and that's uncool, but maybe don't go straight from zero to murder? I don't know. But that's where he goes. And this is the early days of computers, so his home computer doesn't have the juice to summon a full-on demon, so he goes and uses the school computers, because I guess they have, you know, access to, like, the university system or something. And that allows him to summon Loki, who's like, yeah, sure, I'm cool. I'll go murder your friends. And, you know, all you have to do is sacrifice women to me. It's a great deal, right? And Nakajima's totally cool with that until Loki accidentally kills one of the teachers he likes, at which point he says, you know what? Maybe I took this too far. But by then, it's too late. And Loki's already gotten one of his other teachers pregnant. It's a whole mess. Anyway, so then, of course, that classic anime trope, the transfer student, she shows up, Yumiko, and finally, there's a woman cool and pure and smart enough to make even Nakajima's horrible, sickly little heart say, oh, wow, I like her. And, of course, Loki's like, okay, cool. So she can be my sacrifice next. And Nakajima says no. And that's when they part ways and Loki goes on a rampage and tries to murder all of Tokyo. And so Nakajima and Yumiko team up together to stop Loki. And somewhere along the way, we find out that Yumiko is the reincarnation of the goddess. As hinted at in the title, she is the Megami who got tensei'd. And Loki kills her, but, you know, being the reincarnation of a goddess, the goddess that she reincarnated, who actually still exists, and also of whom Nakajima is an aspect, I'm not really clear on how this mythology works, brings Yumiko back to life, and they all team up with Cerberus and kill Loki. And that seems like the happy ending, but then the teacher who is carrying Loki's baby is very sad that Tom Hiddleston had to die. So she gets onto the computers and tries to contact Loki and bring him back to life, but accidentally contacts Set, the Egyptian god of the dead, expanding the pantheon and setting into motion the events of the Pyramids of Mars as well as the next novel.
And then it continues like that.
Yes. That is the first novel. I haven't read all of the second novel or any of the third. But the second novel, the main villain is Set. And in the third novel, the main villain apparently is Lucifer. So you keep going through these various horrible, evil demon figureheads of various world mythologies. kind of upping the stakes, I guess. Lucifer being, you know, from at least from the Western mindset, the Judeo-Christian mindset, like the really big bad guy. I don't know if that was the intent necessarily there, but it kind of works. So, yeah, anyway, I found it really difficult to sympathize with Nakajima, and found Yumiko a much more compelling character, even though she's not really that much of a character. She's just kind of like this object in the story who inspires the horrible main character and then dies and then comes back and then kind of is trapped in a limbo state because she's got to hang out with the goddess that she reincarnated so they can do good works in the world. It's a little fuzzy, but yeah, it's, apparently it was very popular, and so they decided to turn it into video games and a cartoon. I don't know why that is.
It's crazy to me that the game even came out, because this is for adults. Like, there is so much violence and sex in the anime that they made this to market this demon summoning game, and that the children would get it and not only understand the story but be able to play it. I mean, we also got like Rambo games and stuff when we were children, but I feel like this is even it's on another level.
Yeah, I mean, we got I've done episodes on this about how weird it was that we got stuff like RoboCop and Die Hard as, you know, games for kids, when kids definitely could not watch those movies in theaters at the time. But, you know, they also turned RoboCop into like a cartoon where he flies around on a jetpack. They turned it into a Marvel comic where he like fights gorillas. So at some point, media properties kind of take on a life of their own, detached from the original source material. But this one, I don't feel that was the case with the original Megami Tensei. The sequel, definitely, because it's basically like saying, here's the pretext, you can summon demons from a computer, go for it, but has nothing to do narratively with the books. But this is very much, the game is very much part three, the alternate take on Demise of the Reincarnation, the third novel. Because at this point in the story, Nakajima and Yumiko have defeated Set, and they've defeated Loki, and so they have to go into a dungeon that Lucifer has created. And, you know, because what kind of villain would you be if you didn't create an elaborate first-person dungeon for someone to fight through? And so that's kind of the premise of the game, is fight Lucifer, fight the reincarnations of Set and Loki and various other mini-bosses, and team up with demons that you can summon through your computer, because you carry your computer around with you at all times in the labyrinth, as one does. So there's a note on here about novel illustrations. I didn't realize it was an illustrated novel, having, you know, just read the online translation.
Yeah, most light novels, they were set aside were because they had illustrations like that. And it was done by the guy who did Gundam Double Zeta.
Your notes say Hiroyuki Kitazume.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was a well-known animator at the time, so he was kind of a big get.
Mm-hmm. Was he also responsible for like the cover art, the game box art, etc.?
I don't think they reused his art, so I don't know if he did work directly on it, but just by virtue of like going across media, yeah, it's his stuff.
Right, yeah, but I mean that's his illustrations that
yeah,
like the cover is very, it's very 1980s Japanese you know, pop media painting, so it has that sort of distinct style, but yeah, it's definitely dated but still really good. There's also a note in here about Giten Megami Tensei Tokyo Mokushiroku for PC 98. I don't know anything about this game. Whoever added that note, please tell us about that, because it sounds interesting.
So, one main point that I wanted to bring up is that the original Megami Tensei is a really horror novel. There's so much violence in it. But when it came to consoles, all that was sanded away. Like, there's like demons and stuff in it, but like they can't show decapitated heads and stuff like that. So Giten Megami Tensei was much later. It was in the late 90s. And that is like an alternate universe Shin Megami Tensei where they kept all the horror stuff. Like, there's a lot of violence and a lot of nudity in that game. And personally, I think the series worked better when it just focuses on post-apocalyptic and urban fantasy and mythology compared to, like, I don't know. I find that some of the stuff in that was really unpleasant. But I guess horror fans would maybe find that to be a different vibe. But I think the direction that the video games took ultimately defined where it is now.
That makes sense. Yeah, I mean, I have to say that the first Megami Tensei doesn't really get into the, like, the urban futurism that we associate with the Megaten series. It's all set in this sort of fantasy labyrinth that's divided into different zones. There's, like, the Daedalus zone, which is kind of based on, you know, obviously Greek mythology. And then there's, like, a Mesoamerican pyramid and sort of a European castle, if I'm not mistaken. So you're kind of moving through these different zones progressively that take on a different flavor, and you fight different kinds of, you know, appropriate enemies there. For example, you know, in the Daedalus Temple, the mini bosses there are the Minotaur and Medusa, who, you know, are appropriate for something based on ancient Greek myth. But it also kind of established the foundation of, like, those often appearing as the first, you know, major bosses that really force you to stop and say, oh, maybe I'm not ready to advance into this game yet because I clearly don't understand all the mechanics or have a party that is, you know, suited to taking on these extremely powerful and dangerous foes. Like, certainly Shin Megami Tensei 4, I feel, you know, was really calling back to the original Megami Tensei with presenting Minotaur and Medusa as two of its first bosses, kind of in the zone that you face before you really get into the game proper.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. No, the thing one of the things I really love about kind of the initial kind of design is, you know, this is like the tabletop thing of, like, the mega dungeon where you have, you know, the players are kind of within its own contained labyrinth that has ecology and NPCs of its sort. Like, you know, we're you know, you start the game in a town that's kind of in the dungeon, and, like, you know, you don't there's not an overworld, there's not even, like, a forest that you're walking through. It's just, you are just in this dungeon, and eventually you will come across people that have, like, carved out, like, an existence inside of it. And it's just like, hi, I'm the armor salesman that just, like, lives here in this, like, nightmare, like, sewer system, basically. Hi, you want to buy some new gear? Which gives it this very interesting vibe, because the whole thing takes place in this weird, like, Mesoamerican pyramid. It has this, like, you know, very strange claustrophobic vibe, but, like, there's still all of these weird NPCs that you run across, like, just living their lives within it, and not necessarily for just the existence of the player, which kind of has an interesting, there's not a lot of writing in this game, but what's there is very curious and inspiring.
The graphic design of this game is just—it's very weird.
Uh-huh. Yes.
One game that Atlus put around the same time was called Bio Senshi Dan, and I'm like, there was no credits on that game, but I'm pretty sure it's the same graphic designer because it shares that same. I don't even know what you'd call it. Just very strange.
Things feel very
The demons are almost kind of cute. They have this, like, very sort of squat, chunky, rounded style to them. They're not super deformed. They're not quite cute, cartoon, chibi, whatever you want to call it, but they're kind of trending in that direction. Like, they really don't feel like super threatening monsters. It's almost like they kind of wanted to make it horror and spooky and dangerous, but also were like, those cute Akira Toriyama designs worked so well in Dragon Quest. We should venture into that direction. So it does have this very weird style. This was before, Kazuma Kanoko started working on the series. So it doesn't have his very distinct sort of cold, almost impersonal art style to it yet. Everything is just kind of a little weird looking, sometimes kind of gross looking, but in a way that has a lot of character and charisma. It is really hard to describe, but it has a look quite unlike any other RPG I can think of.
One of my favorite things is the bug demon in this one, which is just Baku that's like flipping back and forth, and like it says bug on the side of it, and it's we're summoning demons with a computer and it glitched. Mm-hmm. Like,
is that the same joke as in Zelda 2 bug Baku?
Is it Zelda 2? I don't remember.
You know, there's error and bug.
Oh, Baku, yeah. Yeah.
Man.
No, this is
was this an actual bug? I don't know. I have to look on TCR.
No, it's not a bug, like an actual programming bug. It's in the game as an enemy. It's like the like Dia said, it's the Baku sprite, but it like randomly flips upside down and flashes, and the word bug is superimposed over it. So yeah, it's like your summoning computer is glitching out, and you're getting this kind of weird. Like missing no, essentially, except deliberate.
Huh. In the original Famicom version of Megami Tensei, while fighting a bug, if the player held down the A, B, left, and down buttons on the second controller and auto-battled the bug, a message would appear saying, Kabu-chan begins debugging.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah, it's on TCRF, yeah. Too. It's like a weird Easter egg.
Yeah, it feels like the game programmer, like, kind of making a joke. At their own expense, or like, you know, about the difficulties of creating the game. So very sort of metatextual. But the idea of taking a computer into a horror demon labyrinth to do RPG battling, like, I can't think of a lot of other cases where you'd see something like that. I mean, you know, obviously the Ultima games kind of combined fantasy and sci-fi in that sort of 1970s way. But yeah, like generally RPGs of this era, computer RPGs or console RPGs, really sort of stuck to like, you are a dude with a sword and armor and you have to save a princess, go fight the kobolds and the slimes. And this definitely has that, except, you know, instead of saving a princess, you've got the priestess reincarnation goddess lady who's running around with you, saving your ass by casting healing spells. And you summon computer or summon demons by using a computer. So it's kind of bending some of the rules a little bit. I guess at the same time, you did have Phantasy Star, which was, you know, just like, this is science fiction, the RPG. Please enjoy.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's also like there, you know, kind of concurrently, like in like the late 70s and through the 80s, you did start getting like people started getting weird with computers once they started getting them home and they could start doing computational things. So you did get like these weird metaphysical software applications that people were working on and like, you know, using. Like, there's a lot of, like, you know, astrological software, you know, because you didn't have, you could program that into a computer and have it do the calculations for you rather than having to sit there and do weird astrology on your own. So, like, there are these weird things floating around at the edges that kind of, like, do kind of culminate in coming into this, you know, as, like, kind of flavor from the era.
Yeah, I mean, I've done a video on the Super Cassette Vision game Milky Princess, which is as in like the Milky Way, as in it's an astrology program that's like telling you about your compatibility with the boy of your dreams and that sort of thing. So, you know, that was considered, you know, like software. There was the Uranai 89 cartridge. I can't remember the full title, but it was basically like, we're here in the year 1989. Please buy this software to learn your fortune via Famicom for the year ahead, which, you know, not necessarily a game with long lives, with a long shelf life, but just very much a part of that, like, computers can do everything. Let's see what we can squeeze out of our video game. All right, so in Megami Tensei, the video game, you do play as Nakajima and Yumiko. Both of those are your human party members. They are with you at all times. They are often dead with you at all times, but they can't both be dead, or that's the end of the game. Even when you have demons in your party, the humans are the load-bearing characters, and if they're both gone, then that's it. And that's something that was carried forward into a lot of subsequent Persona and Shin Megami Tensei games. Like, there was a sort of key figure, and if they're out, then that's it for the game. So that kind of started here, but bringing demons into your party does give you much greater survivability, because you can put them in the front row to be your, you know, kind of punching bags. Some of them have healing spells. I think one or two of them have a resurrection spell. I don't know. I've only really read about the more advanced demons because I have not made it that far into this game. But there are a lot of restrictions involved in summoning demons. There are some demons that cannot be summoned or, you know, recruited into your party. Once you summon a demon, you can't take it out of your party unless you just let it die and then go and get a password for the game while the demon is dead, and then it will just be erased from your party when you start the password save. Very kind of clunky, very, you know, there's no battery in this cartridge, so it's very unfriendly in the way that so many games of this era were. Expects a lot of players. But, you know, we were kids. We all had infinite time. What else was there to do besides grind in a dungeon and write down passwords?
Well, there is kind of like a Tower of Daraga, like, you know, passing notes about, you know, what you figured out, kind of like vibe to that, which I thought, you know, mm-hmm. You know, like, Daraga famously, like, I don't know how we figured out things about that game. Like, if people didn't just, like, literally just, like, leave, like, note cards at the arcade just being like, yo, on level 3, do this. For some of the Megami Tensei, like, if I didn't look it up, there wasn't game facts. I don't know how I would have figured it out. Unless, like, everyone at school was playing it, and then it was like, okay, we could all talk about this. Which I think, I wish games did that more today. You know, I think that is something that is, there is a weird, you know, meta-social aspect to gaming that, like, is low-key kind of lost by games being a little bit, like, more streamlined and respectful of player time and so on and so forth. That something like Megami Tensei, like, really just, like, leans heavily into, I think, partially, or at least, I don't know that it does it very intentionally. I think there is an aspect of intentionality to it, but some of it, I think, is just, like, look, we're figuring this out as we go along. I remember having conversations about, like, Simon's Quest and, like, who's lying. You know, at, like, recess, and then, like, going home and being like, ah, oh, damn, okay, yeah, you're right, I gotta do this. It's not Deborah Cliff's business. That's not what we're doing here. Okay.
I can't hit my head against Deborah Cliff. That's not one of the commands. It's not in my menu. Yeah, I feel like the last game that really, really thrived on that sort of player-to-player communication and sharing notes and stuff was World of Warcraft. And then, you know, a couple of years into it, people started to get organized and created wikis, and anything you needed to know was just laid out in that wiki. So I feel like it's really difficult to have that sort of prolonged sense of discovery, that peer-to-peer experience, mm-hmm. In the age of the internet and communal wikis and things like that. You know, FromSoft has tried to capture that with notes and engravings and stuff in their various Souls-type games. And that's kind of cool. Like, there's still, you know, the external wikis, but this is something within the actual game itself. Mm-hmm. So it kind of it kind of transcends that and means that you can use the tools within the game to kind of pull from the community instead of, you know, just going to a fan wiki. So, yeah, I totally agree. And I also recognize that we live in a different world. And even at the time, 1987, any video game that came out in 1987 for Famicom, it had a strategy guide, at least one, sometimes three or four. So I feel like if you got frustrated enough with Megami Tensei, you could trust that in a month or two, you would be able to go to, you know, your favorite bookstore and spend 800 yen and buy a strategy guide for Megami Tensei that would give you most, if not all, the information you needed. So we had kind of gotten away from that communal notes period that made Tower of Daraga so compelling and famous in Japan just through the sheer power of commercial potential. Yeah. The fact that someone could sell you answers for money and would happily do that.
That's how I learned to play RPGs in general. One of the first RPGs I ever played was my dad's Atari 400. It's called Alibaba and the 40 Thieves. And I could not understand any of it. But even back then, they had books that would, you know, like walk you through not only adventure games, but Ultima and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of like to pat myself on the back for being so good at video games back in the day and, you know, figuring out games like Dragon Warrior and so forth. But going back and covering those games for NES Works and, you know, pulling together all the Nintendo Power coverage that existed for those games, I'm like, oh, I figured out nothing on my own. Every detail of these games was laid out and given to me on a platter. And I had no deductive or reasoning abilities of my own. I just followed instructions, and I was actually a very stupid child who just had Nintendo Power. And it's been humbling, but at least, you know, it's good to realize these things about yourself as you get older and recognize that, no, I wasn't really a special child. I just thought I was. But anyone could have done this if they had the Nintendo Power, you know, guides from 1989 that just laid out every possible detail of Dragon Warrior. So, you know, it's a cold shot of reality, but at least, you know, it puts me in my place.
No, the secret was being the one kid. Wow, what were the series of VHS tapes that like did like the NES?
Oh, the players, game players, game tapes.
Yes,
I'm looking at a stack of them right now.
Yes, I was like, I thought you were like posting about them not too long ago.
I digitized those so I can throw little bits of footage into my videos at some point.
Now, I remember walking into school like God with the Simon's Quest, like, maxed everything, get the best ending password, and just being like, you're like, here you guys go, you can have this. And then my friend Earl just calling me and be like, bullshit, you watched that video. Just like, shut up, I did it myself.
You call him a friend, but was he really? To understand about Megami Tensei, if you have not played it before, is that it is an unrepentantly old school RPG.
Yes.
Like I said, you play as the two humans, you can summon demons, you can recruit them, but there's so many things about it that are just like, they would never do this in a modern RPG. It is a first-person dungeon RPG. Okay, those still exist. Sure, that's fine. But there are so many limitations on it. There is no in-game map unless you use some of Yumiko's precious magic power to cast a spell that creates a little mini-map in the side of the screen that sort of shows your immediate surroundings, but doesn't give you like the full context of the map. And as Dia said, you can't cast it during certain periods. So, you know, when the moon is in a certain phase, then you're out of luck and you have no map. Many status ailments are permanent, and you don't gain the ability to clear them away until very late in the game, once Yumiko gets high-level magic. I think some of the spells are like level 26 or 27, and this is, you know, old school RPG, that's going to be like 40 to 50 hours of gameplay to get to that level. So when you get a status ailment, you can either walk around poisoned, or you can go back to the town at the beginning of the maze and have those things cleared by paying someone to heal you and then start your journey all over again. When both human characters die, that's it. The game ends. I will say that, you know, it does at least take a lesson from Dragon Quest. It doesn't permanently screw you over. You keep your progress to that point, but it sends you back to the beginning, which, you know, you go there all the time anyway, so who cares? And you lose half your cash. But you do keep your party intact. So there's that at least. Let's see. When a demon dies, you can only revive it at a specific place in the dungeon. So again, you're trekking to specific locations, a few limited locations within the dungeon, constantly, over and over again. So it's just... It's not a friendly game. The dungeon window itself only takes up like a quarter of the screen, so it feels very cramped, and there's a lot of information surrounding it all around. So you kind of have to strain to see what's happening. So it's very limited. But the whole introduction of the demon recruitment and summoning, I think, really balances that out by making it very compelling and giving you a lot of options for play. You have to recruit demons, like we said before, and you talk to them. You can threaten them. You can coax them. You can bribe them. There's lots of ways to talk a demon into joining your party. As Kurt said, it all seems very random at times, but if you manage to recruit a demon, which you can only do when a demon is by itself, when it has no allies on screen, if you can, you know, impress them into your group, then you have a potentially very powerful ally who can team up with you. On top of that, you have the demon fusion function, which started all the way back here, surprisingly enough. And there is a complex chart of basically genus and species for demons that determines which demons can be combined. If they can't be combined, then you get like a default demon. But basically you have the ability to join different demons together and potentially create a much more powerful one that has even greater abilities. And this would, you know, in subsequent games, take on new features like elemental attributes and carrying forward spells and determining what you want to do and how you want to build a demon. So you can create demons with like no weaknesses or, you know, superpowers or whatever that can really unbalance the game for you. But it was much simpler here, but still pretty complicated for a Famicom game.
You should also note this applies to some of the early Shin Megami Tensei games too. Your demons don't level up, like only the human characters do. So that's like the really big impetus to either recruit more or fuse more powerful demons. And even in the newer games, there's always like an upper limit to how high they can grow because they don't want you to keep around the same demon.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, again, it's very similar to the monster feature in the Saga games where, you know, a monster, you create it, it's very powerful, but eventually your team is going to level up beyond it, so you have to eat some meat and create a more powerful monster, hopefully.
Well, it's always, like, you know, the frustrating aspect of, like, okay, I need to, you know, I need access to, like, you know, elemental fire, but, like, you know, the last fire demon that I know how to create reliably is like 10 levels below where I'm at now. And so you're having to like figure out how to make all of these, like, you know, these moves strategically to be effective with combat wise, but also just be able to survive and things like that. And like, you know, sometimes there are just real limitations on what you are capable of creating because you have to have demons in your party in order to like fuse them. And like, you know, I remember doing the Let's Play, just like having really bad runs where I just could not get, you know, the one Baku that I needed in order to like, you know, complete the fusion and just be like, fuck, how am I supposed to get to this boss? I can't even get through this level because I can't get the demons I need to show up even sometimes. It was really like, it can get really frustrating. But it can also be fun that way, where you're just kind of forced to be like, well, I don't know what this tree guy is, his deal is, but like, you know, let's roll deep with an, you know, squad of Ents right now. We'll figure it out.
Gonna go roll deep and find the Ent wives, like, wherever they've gone. Yeah, so the one last thing I want to say about the demons in this game is that compared to the later Megami and Shin Megami and Persona games, they're not really that heavily focused on the mythological characters. A lot of the monsters you fight in this game are just kind of your standard generic RPG types, like slimes and kobolds and gnomes. And, you know, some of those are drawn from various world mythologies and legends and that sort of thing, but they're fairly standard. You kind of see the more mythology-based characters in, you know, the forms of bosses and sort of the higher-level creatures that surround the bosses. And even then, you have, like, Medusa and Minotaur become so much a common part of video games that they don't necessarily stand out, and it's not until you start facing Egyptian gods and Lucifer and, you know, his satanic throng that you kind of start to see the sort of world mythology element that you associate with this franchise. That's something that would kind of come into play later. But it's interesting because, you know, you still do see a lot of those characters, those monster types, in subsequent Megaten games. And they tend to be sort of the non-affiliated races, like Foul or something along those lines, that, you know, they often can't be combined with other creatures to fuse demons, more powerful demons. So it does kind of carry forward, the series kind of carries forward that element, that lineage that started here. And it is interesting to sort of see how these things are interpreted by the modern games and kind of what's become a tradition, you know, because every RPG series that runs for a long time and mutates does have its own tendencies and traditions. And that seems to be, you know, one of the elements that has kind of held steadfast through the evolution of Megaten. Any other thoughts on Megami Tensei?
Soundtrack slaps.
Oh, yeah. The Tsukasa Masuko.
Yeah.
Did a lot of the early... He was around for Atlus for a very long time, and he stayed with the series up until probably through the 32-bit era. Other composers kind of took over in the PlayStation 2. He's still on the scene. But yeah, the soundtrack is phenomenal. It's a lot of good music.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're talking Namco and Atlus here, so if it didn't have good music, I would kind of feel like, you know, there was a glitch in the Matrix. Another one of those demons running through the computers, messing things up. I feel like the series or this game did pretty well for itself because 3 years later, Namco and Atlus teamed up again to create Megami Tensei 2, the not actually a sequel to Megami Tensei. The sequel has nothing to do with the previous game aside from the fact that you are a kid in the modern world who can use computers to summon demons.
I'm surprised this was able to exist. You know, just from a pure intellectual property standpoint, because Megami Tensei 2 is not a sequel to the novels, it's a sequel to the game, which was its own thing. And I mean, like, the guy was still writing novels along with this, and I guess maybe it built some brand recognition, but it has nothing to do with it. I feel like in the modern day, if they wanted to make a sequel to their game, they would have to come up with their own name. But I don't know, maybe Namco was able to throw their weight around and was able to make it happen.
Yeah, I mean, we did get Parasite Eve 2 that had nothing to do with the novel Parasite Eve, like, you know, just kind of its own, doing its own thing. I assume they gave the author some money or their publisher and said, hey, we're going to do this. We're going to keep going. And that's how you end up with this. It's kind of the Star Soldier of JRPGs. You know, you had Star Force... and that did okay for Tecmo, and then Hudson brought it to Famicom, and it was a huge hit. And Hudson said, we like this. We're going to keep doing this, except we're going to change it a little and call it Star Soldier, and you can't have any money. And so this kind of, I kind of feel like this is sort of pushing in that direction a little bit.
It's probably better that they got rid of Nakajima.
Yes. Yeah, you know, it's cancel culture at its best. Just get rid of the toxic personality and start fresh. Take the good ideas and get rid of the horrible people. So, yeah, I haven't really spent any time with this one, unlike the first game. But what I've, you know, dabbled in, I was really surprised that it's not initially a dungeon crawler. Like, looking at videos, it does turn that way later. But it starts out as just like an overworld type, you know, Final Fantasy looking RPG. Like, if you look at footage of it, you might think, oh, is this a Saga game? But it's not. It's the game that Saga borrowed so much from.
Oh, it's super clever. I love this device. You're playing a game within a game, which is based off of the original Megami Tensei.
Oh, is that what it's about?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you go through that sequence, and there's a couple different floors of it. And then you beat the Minotaur at the end, and then a demon talks to your characters, and it's revealed that you and your buddy are actually in an underground shelter. Tokyo or Japan or whatever has been destroyed, you know, a couple of decades ago, and you've been living in relative peace down there. And then after beating this level of the game, the god Pazuzu comes out and says, you know, you're the saviors of the world. You have to leave and find your destiny on the surface. And just around that same time, demons breach the shelter anyway. So you and your buddy have to get your equipment and fight your way out and explore post-apocalyptic Tokyo first to find out what Pazuzu is up to.
Okay, so this is very much like I can see where Shin Megami Tensei 4 came from.
Yes.
With the whole, like, you're hanging out in a cool fantasy kingdom and you got to go fight Medusa. And whoa, actually, Tokyo is post-apocalyptic and it's been wrecked for a long time and it's up to you to fix it.
Yep.
Nice. I didn't realize that was a... Yeah, there's so much I'm missing out on by not having been able to play localized versions of these games 30 years ago. Damn.
So it's so much more expansive than the original Megami Tensei, because that was just, you know, a wizardry type game. There are different zones that you would go into, but you never left the dungeon. And this game has an overworld, which is, you know, taken straight out of Final Fantasy or whatever else in the area. And the dungeons are still first-person dungeon crawling, so it still maintains that aspect, and it still plays very similarly otherwise. But the story is also so much more advanced. Because there's a lot of wild stuff that happens as you go through this game.
Yes, it seems like it has the classic, again, Shin Megami Tensei 4, where you've got a friend who parts ways with you, and there's a lady character who you become close to, and kind of there's a question of who are you going to ally with. I'm seeing some mechanisms and tropes here that continue to survive throughout the series. Multiple endings. It doesn't seem like there's necessarily the alignment element going on, but kind of the actions you take lead to different endings. And it kind of, just from what I've read, seems like you have to make some unintuitive decisions in order to get the true ending.
Well, as you go through the game, like, you meet the woman and... Your character, there's no choice in this. Your character aligns with the woman because, you know, she's the future. And your buddy has been traveling with you, disagrees. So he goes off in his other direction. And he ends up becoming an enemy and you have to fight him. But at a certain point, you do beat Bale, I think. I always get confused, Bale and Ball. But whatever. The main demon you're supposed to fight. You beat him and you turn him in, he turns into a frog. And depending on what you do after that determines what happens during the rest of the game. Because you can, I think, kill him, and then you have to beat up a bunch of demons, and you end up in heaven, but you don't save anything. Something like that. But if you don't, then you go through the rest of the game, where you ally with Lucifer, and then you have to take down, rather famously take down Yahweh at the end of the game.
Basically, if you let the frog live, then you team up with the villain. Is that correct?
Let Let me double check to make
so
sure
like,
I have that right.
Chrono Trigger took this idea and twisted it by letting Frog's nemesis live. Then you get to team up with the villain.
If you finish off the... Yeah, if you beat the frog, it leads you to, like, the bad-ish ending. So it's not quite the... There's no... Like you said, there's no alignment like there is in the other games, but there is multiple endings, which is... I mean, technically Dragon Quest had multiple endings, but that is a little bit more advanced. Like, the bad ending is clearly the bad ending here. But it's a little bit more. Like, there's more of the game afterwards, if you let the frog live.
Got it. So it's like the bonus story mode. Okay, it's out. Yeah, I need to sit down and play this. But it's only recently been localized, right?
Yeah, like it's fan translations. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think there's also the remakes of the first two games that were combined on the same Super Famicom cartridge. I think that might have been fan translated too. I want to say that came out first before the fan translation of the Famicom game.
Well, it's time for me to look at romhacking.net.
Yeah.
Anyway, Dia, do you have much experience with this one? I know you've talked about trying to stream and do Let's Plays of Megami Tensei, but what about 2?
I poked at it enough to like kind of get just a very general sense of it, but when I was going to do the Let's Plays of it, and then just to make sure like it worked, the translation was like, you know, legitimate and kind of you know, that there was enough there, and that was about it.
It's still a tough game. Like what I mentioned before, the last time I tried playing it, you know, you try to converse with like a chainsaw dudes or whatever is running around, and they're like, we don't want to join you, we'll call another guy, and then keep calling another guy and just mess you up.
Okay, it looks like Kyuyaku Megami Tensei, the Super Famicom remake of 1 and 2, was fan-translated nearly 10 years ago, so I totally overlooked that. I was waiting for the Famicom version like a sucker, because I'm sure the Super Famicom version has a lot of refinements and quality of life changes that would make it more enjoyable to play, besides just, you know, having nicer graphics.
Yes and no, because the Old Testament, the Kyuyaku games, they both redo all the visuals and the sound to be like the other Super Famicom games, and those are cool, but they also completely ditched the unique style that both of these games had. Megami Tensei 2 is a very strange visual style too, because it has a lot of like unusual colors for the dungeons. Almost eye-searing, I guess just to give it some variety and to you know, make it seem like there's more variety than just whatever what you could fit in a 4 megabit ROM. But again, the music for this, it used one of Namco's special mapper chips that had extra sound channels like Konami's did. Mm-hmm. And it is really a really stellar soundtrack. Like, even the introduction section to the game uses a lot of music from the original Megami Tensei, which has been rearranged, and it just sounds fantastic. It's so good. And the official soundtrack release actually includes an arranged CD with the music was redone by Ryo Yonemitsu, who had done the TurboGrafx arrangements of like the first 4 East games and some of the other Falcom stuff. So it has that real big synth power rock, and it's a great set.
I'm looking at some scans of an art book based on Megami Tensei 2, and even the demons have a very distinct style. This was Kaneko's first project, and it kind of his beginning with the series. And he was, you know, clearly kind of young and sort of finding his style here. So you can kind of recognize it as his style, but it's also just very different than the more cool, refined artwork that he would create in later games. So that, and you know, it translates very interestingly into 8-bit sprites. Like, there's a lot of detail in these sprites, and there's a lot of the sprites too. But they all, like, even though there's some designs that definitely you'll recognize, like, oh yeah, that's Kaneko's characters. A lot of the character designs, like Pixie and Jack Frost, look pretty different than kind of what you're expecting and what you're used to.
This is the first game that had Jack Frost in it also, but yeah, he looks a lot different than how he became as a mascot.
I like this one. He's like a little snowman with a muffler and a top hat and boots and an umbrella. It's cute.
Oh, this game introduces the little Oni marks, which are in like so many of the other games in the series in different capacities. Like it's like the original Dragon Quest. I guess it's more like Phantasy Star, where you only see one enemy on the screen at a time, but you're technically fighting multiple enemies at once. And you have these little icons of the screen that show how many there are and their statuses. So it shows when they're getting weak, or you know, they kill one that disappears. And that became a sort of, again, big thing for the series that kept on for a long time.
So this is the first of the games to really be set in a post-apocalyptic Tokyo, which is more kind of what people expect from the Megaton series. You either discover, oh, someone blitzed Tokyo a long time ago, or else somewhere midway through the story, you are part of the process of Tokyo getting blitzed. So kind of really setting the tone here. I mean, this really does feel like the first Megami Tensei kind of feels like the first Mega Man to me, where it looks a little weird and like the ideas are there, but it's kind of half formed. And then Megami Tensei 2 is the Mega Man 2, where it's just like everything kind of falls into place. It's much more its own thing. There are more unique ideas. Everything is just refined better, looks better, sounds better, plays better, etc. It's bigger. Is that a fair comparison?
Absolutely.
And they both have Mega in the name, so I feel like that's very well suited to the comparison. But looking at the first two Megaton games before we call it a night and wrap up this podcast, how, you know, for people who are familiar with the modern SMT games, you know, three and onward, how would you say these first two games are different from the Shin Megami Tensei games and obviously the Persona games?
I mean, Shin Megami Tensei is basically Megami Tensei 3. But the games aren't always connected to each other. Like, Shin Megami Tensei 1 and 2 particularly are, but Shin Megami Tensei is not a sequel to Megami Tensei 2, because they wanted to show you the whole Tokyo getting destroyed angle again. Mm-hmm. And there is on a Japanese website that I read, and I'm going to re-quote again, is that both of the Super Famicom Shin Megami Tensei games are sort of like Mother 2 compared to Mother 1 as the original Megami Tensei. It's not a sequel, it's not a remake, but it explores a lot of the same things, and there's a lot of reoccurring stuff.
So kind of the way like the Final Fantasy games work, where it's, you know, especially the early days, where there's, you know, an evil creature, it involves crystals, something's happening, there's elements, but it's not necessarily like, it's not the same world, it doesn't have any connection to the others. Maybe Gilgamesh shows up, but that's about it.
Yeah. So it's sort of like the Super Famicom games were like that, but, you know, at a higher level of technology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's see. My own notes. It seems like, especially in in Megami Tensei 1, you can play a lot more of the game without necessarily summoning demons. It does seem like there's a point at which you just have to kind of buckle down and say, all right, time to get some demons in the party. But then you have the... what was the magnetite element, where when you have demons summoned in your party, their presence in the party consumes magnetite with every step that you take in the dungeon, and the more powerful the demon you have, the more magnetite it consumes. So basically saying, like, you have to have these guys in order to survive, but we're going to punish you if you have them out. We're going to consume your resource. So just one of those, you know, sort of unflinching, unforgiving type game design choices that I don't remember from any of the other Megaton games. I feel like Strange Journey had something somewhat similar in some capacity. It's been a while since I've played, but not to that degree.
The last game that I'm pretty sure used it was Soul Hackers, which had come out in the 3DS.
That's the one I'm thinking
that
of,
version,
yeah.
At that point, it had been eliminated from the series, so there's a little, like, almost cheat menu in that game. You can just turn it off. I think that mechanic was there just to give the game some balance, because you could get all these high-level demons and just crunch it if you wanted to. Crush it, I should say. But you would be limited to how much you can move with a high-level party, so you were supposed to be able to balance it out. I don't think it really ever worked like that, because it just promoted more grinding to get more magnetite. So after the 32-bit era, they just realized it was more of a burden and got rid of it.
Yeah, it was really like just like defeating to like have to use your magnetite in order to grind more magnetite, and then like you just end up like, you know, not getting enough, and it's just like, wow, I just spent 3 hours of my time at a net loss of magnetite.
Oh, yeah, Soul Hackers had that whole system where you could like go to an exchange rate and all that sort of stuff. Like, they really built it into it for like, it's really just more work.
it kind of reminds me of the Magic Experience system that Lunar 2 incorporated, and then Working Designs was like, what if you had to use this in order to save your game? What a great idea. Yeah, so I can see why that sort of thing went away, and all for the better. But the final thing I want to put out here, someone added at the very end of the notes, I don't know who it was, but thank you, you're a genius. The interesting discussion question, will we ever see these remakes, the Super Famicom remakes of Mega Man 10 1 and 2, in English someday, considering that Atlas has been pretty enthusiastic about kind of revisiting these older games and turning them into English. I don't know. Like, what do you think?
I think, and I've said this before about the Shin Megami Tensei games, I think that they believe that they're too old, because there's always a certain level of first-person dungeon crawling that I think people look at it and just nope out of it immediately. They won't even try it. And that, like, you can still see like Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy. They have the pixel remakes or mobile versions a lot. They've kept in, and you know, even though they're a little old and maybe a little grindy, like people can still play them pretty easily. But when you give them a first person dungeon crawler, it just is just so much harder to do. So I feel like if they wanted to do this, they would have to do a proper remake, which would just take too many resources. And I don't think that would even work for the first Megami Tensei, because that is a dungeon crawler. You really, I guess, could change the perspective, but that is the game. Like, you can't really do much else with it. Whereas you could take Megami Tensei 2 and Shin Megami Tensei 1 and 2 and make a modernish game if they wanted to. And I think it would be really cool, because it has a lot of really cool ideas. At the same time, if you played any of the more recent Shin Megami Tensei games, I don't think they have a good grasp on how to write them in the way that they used to. I think the older games really benefited from not having a whole lot of space to tell a story. Like, the text, especially in Megami Tensei 2 and the Shin Megami Tensei 2, the Super Famicom games, is very terse. It's very direct. There's not much characterization, and I think that works to the game's benefit.
Yeah, I feel like, honestly, like, it was weird to me when we got an SMT5, because I was, like, really just kind of like, oh, Atlas is just going to become the Persona company now. And just, like, because I do, I agree with Kurt, I think these games are too old for modern audiences. I don't think people want first-person dungeon crawlers the way, even, like, you know, the first Persona game is, you know, that first-person dungeon crawl, and it's very fast, but it feels, I think most modern dungeon crawlers are going to look at that and just go like, why am I playing a dungeon crawler? Is this like a weird throwback game? And so I can't imagine Atlas wanting to spend any time on that when they could just like throw resources at making a new Persona or making, you know, SMT 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 or whatever, you know, if they're going to do that kind of thing.
They did localize the first Shin Megami Tensei for the iPhone of all places. And that's the only official English release we've seen. And of course, that all, you know, fell into the iPhone hole once they upgraded to 64-bit and they didn't bother to redo it. I can't imagine that took off very much.
Yeah, like I think what people come to kind of Atlas, you know, RPGs in, you know, the 2020s, it's not what Megaten has, like, you know, Megami Tensei has on offer for, like, and I don't know how one would bring that forward except as anything other than we did a quick localization based off of, like, the fan patches kind of thing, and we threw them on, like, the Switch. Which, like, you know, like, do that. Like, you know, like, I would like to see that, and I'd like to see just, like, you know, just the most basic port of Sorcerian come to America. Just so people stop looking at me like I'm ridiculous when I talk about them. But I don't see them... You know, I don't know that there is a fork where we have that future for the original Mega Ten games.
I will say that as someone who works at a publisher that likes to republish or bring games to modern systems that have maybe never been published in the US before, the question of using fan translations is fraught. That's not going to happen. There's so much liability involved in that. You don't even want to know. But I think that we could see remakes of these games if Atlus were a smaller company. I think Atlus is used to success on a larger scale now and only will pursue games that have that kind of potential, like the potential to sell like SMT5 or Persona 5. If Atlus were like an NIS-sized company, if they were, you know, kind of scraping by on Disgaea sequels, they would absolutely be like, let us dig up these ancient-ass games from a series that people kind of like and localize them into English for the first time. We'll put some ChatGPT on the translations and just get it out there. But they're not going to do that because, you know, as you've both said, this is way too niche for modern American audiences. And just, you know, it wouldn't sell. It would sell, you know, 20,000 copies if they were, you know, having a good day.
Like, even
so,
like,
maybe a little better because there is that SMT fan base. But I think they'd probably buy the first one and be like, ooh, no, I'm not going to do this again. Like, they might buy a physical release just to have as part of their collection. But even that's going to get you, what, 50,000 units at most? That's just not the kind of numbers that Atlus is looking for. From a business perspective, it just doesn't make sense for a company the size and, you know, as successful as Atlus/Sega. So these have been doomed by success.
Like, I feel like, you know, the Persona, just the PSP remake of Persona being just, like, you know, kind of locked to the PSP and not coming forward, or, you know, and the weird state that Persona 2 is still in, those feel more likely as, like, candidates to, like, for Atlus to bring forward. And even then, I don't know, like, you know, I think I was the only person that actually talked up Soul Hackers 2, and that has, like, really nothing to do with Soul Hackers. So, like, you know, yeah. I think their experiments are more just kind of like, well, we see what's worked and what hasn't in terms of the numbers that we like to see. Mm-hmm. I think you're right about that.
I do think there would be an appetite for it because, I mean, even when I first played these games, like, this game predated Fallout by almost a decade, but it is very similar to the original Fallout, except...
A dungeon crawler,
you know, the dungeon crawler, but, like, the whole... theme of it is just more Japanese because it takes place in Tokyo. It has the whole demon summoning thing, but it also has a very unique style and sense of humor to it that I think makes it different from other post-apocalyptic things, just in the same way that Fallout has its own unique voice that, especially with the TV show of that, it's sort of brought back. Mm-hmm. And again, if you the stories, especially from Megami Tensei 2, really cool. But I don't think most people would have the patience to experience it.
I agree. So if you would like to play Megami Tensei 1 and 2 in English, because you are a Persona and Megaton fan, it's your own fault that you can't, because you've made the series too popular for us ever to experience the series' primal roots in English. Pat yourself on the back. You did this to yourself. Anyway, thank you both, Kurt and Dia, for joining me for this episode of Retronauts. This is a patron-exclusive episode, so I'm not going to tell the audience where they can find Retronauts on the internet, because they already know, because they're awesome. But I would love for the two of you to let us know where we can find you and your work online. Dia, what about you?
You can find me basically everywhere / Dia Lucina, because I make it easy to find me or block me. I think with YouTube, you have to add an @ in front of it, because YouTube, despite being Google, does not do anything in a normal way. You can find all my Let's Plays there. You can find me patreon.com/DLacina for the secret subscriber Let's Plays. But otherwise, you can find me writing at Paste occasionally. I'm having a bad couple of months of just life intruding on my ability to write anything, but I'm sure I'll be back there at some point.
Yeah, and every time I make a video that makes fun of Kung Fu Heroes, you can be sure that Dia is going to be out there with a rebuttal.
Fucking rules.
Kurt, what about you?
I'm at hardcoregaming101.net, all one word, on Twitter still at HG_101. I think it's just HG101 on Blue Sky. A Patreon, same deal. I put out a book about the whole Shin Megami Tensei and Persona series. I put out a book about Japanese RPGs published by Bitmap Books. I like Japanese RPGs.
Me too. They're neat.
They're good.
I don't really have time to play them anymore, but you can find me on YouTube making my NES Works and Sega Gaiden videos, and I will be covering very soon, actually about the time this video or this episode comes out, I'll be getting to Phantasy Star and Golvelius on Master System, so that's very exciting. Very much looking yes. Forward to tackling both of those games, and the enormous time sink that they're going to represent in my life. That's going to be perfect with all the things I've got going on otherwise, but that's okay, because that's what it's all about, right? Devoting your lives to old video games at the expense of all else, including your health.
See, the rest of
you can also find me. Go ahead.
See, the rest of us just play the Sega Ages version of Phantasy Star.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I've got to do the Master System version for the sake of my videos, but
I know
that video is going to basically say up front, don't do this. Just go get the Sega Ages version. It's amazing. Anyway, you can also find me at limitedrungames.com here on Retronauts and on Blue Sky as Jay Parrish. And that's about it these days. So thanks, everyone, for listening and supporting Retronauts. Thanks, Kurt. Thanks, Dia. It was great to having you both on. And like I said, I want this to be the first kind of like the spearhead, the vanguard of a much larger Shin Megami Tensei / Persona series of episodes. So you'll be first in line when I start calling people to talk about those games. So hopefully we'll have you back on sometime before too long. In the meantime, everyone get out there and log off before the demons get you.